Anyway, so back to the WSC Linux. Who here has noticed my t-shirt today? Two people, okay. I've got a root password for a machine on my t-shirt. It's for my latest SE Linux Play Machine. Play Machine is a term I coined in 2002 to describe a machine with an open root password to demonstrate the features of SE Linux. So I first ran one of these at a conference in Germany in 2002, which is when I got SE Linux first working reasonably well. So I offered root access to people there, and what I would typically do on that was that it was on the Debian stand, incidentally. So I had a machine sitting there with the hash prompt for the root account, and rm-rf slash is typed in, and invite people to walk past the presenter. I say, look, trust me, you know, it's not going to do any damage. Just to show that SE Linux fully controls all access to the machine. And of course, a demonstration on a stand at a trade show really doesn't give people a chance to try it properly. So then I ran the machine live on the net, so people let people SSH in from around the world and try it out. And through the course of running this, we found a number of things need to be improved. Probably the first thing that was found was when I was running my machine at the Debian stand at the German conference, one of my friends in the Debian project needed some space to store some files. He asked me, how big is the hard drive in your machine? So I told him how big it was. And he said, oh, can I have the root password? And I said, well, sure. I gave him the root password, just like I gave it to everyone else. And he put all his data he wanted to store in the root home directory. And the first time someone typed an RM, it just removed it all. I was like, sorry, I didn't realize you wanted to actually store any data on my machine. I thought you'd realize the point of this. So after that trade show, I changed the SE Linux policy to have all roles for users. So to have the user role, administrator role, had user, staff, and sysadmin roles. And the policy was changed to allow you to easily create extra roles. So when I was doing tutorials on SE Linux at the time, I often had examples of student and professor roles, and examples of how to write policy to allow the professors at a university to access files from the students in terms of submitting assignments, etc., but not allow it the other way around. And over the years, I've run a number of SE Linux Play Machines on the net to demonstrate the policy. One of the, well, first I'll talk about some of the mistakes I've made over the course of this time. The first mistake I made was a fairly big one. I didn't protect the shadow password file from being read. So although the machine was protected from root account directly doing things, you could copy the shadow password file off, run crack on it, and then get back in with my account. And that was a pretty bad mistake, of course. Fixed within 24 hours. Another mistake I made was in the early days, there weren't restrictive types assigned for every file under /dev. And the idea was you'd have certain processes being restricted, and processes that were running with moderate privileges would be allowed to read all the rest and write to all the rest. Now, so the ones that are most important were locked down pretty well. Like for example, the block devices for the hard drive, that was very restricted. But there were a bunch of miscellaneous devices that weren't very restricted at all. And one of which was a device for writing to the firmware of the machine. And it was used by one of the people on Play Machine to overwrite the NVRAM. And they said, hey, I've tried this out, I'm not sure what it's done. So then I had to contact the manufacturer of the machine and say, if I reboot my machine, will it work ever again? And they couldn't tell me. So I just gave it a go, and we booted up again, so it was all fine in that regard, but it was a bit of a close call, I think. Fortunately, actually, this was a machine that had been given to me by Sun for some of my development work, so losing a machine that I hadn't paid for would be not as bad as losing a machine I actually paid for. But it was still a bit of a concern, and I've of course, tightened the policy up a lot. One problem that was discovered at a conference was at the FOSDEM conference in Brussels a few years ago. I had a Play Machine on at the Debian stand there, and there were a bunch of other machines at the Debian stand, one of which was designed to demonstrate Debian on M68K. So they had an old Macintosh running Debian. And that Macintosh ended up being used for the entire conference as a terminal to log into my Play Machine to try and crack it. And one thing that interested me was the spectator interest, because watching a guy trying to crack a machine really, I think, isn't a very interesting task. You see him type a bunch of Unix commands, looking at files and stuff, and unless he actually succeeds, there's nothing to really see. But strangely enough, one guy got a crowd of about 30 people watching him. I never worked it out, but they seemed interested, so it was fun for them, I guess. And he ended up actually finding a flaw in the policy. What it was is the crontab program used to install new crontab files, ran with excessive privileges. So if you ran it with UID 0, then it could read files from other users' home directories and write to those files, but not if you did it from UIDs other than 0. And this was one example of a number of different security issues that we found with SE Linux is that there's a lot of code that assumes that if it's run as UID 0, then it should have ultimate privileges, and therefore all checks are just bypassed. So there's a lot of code saying, if UID equals 0, then do it whatever you like. And whereas with running SE Linux, that's often not the case. You often have cases where a program will be running as root and be running in an untrusted manner, or if you have a program that's legitimately running as root, but it might be cracked. If you're running without SE Linux, then anything running as root that gets cracked, you've just lost the game entirely. Whereas with SE Linux, you know, a program run as root gets cracked, and that doesn't mean that you've entirely lost. So therefore, you still want to have your checks in place to try and prevent the privilege being escalated even further. And a lot of programs don't have these checks. Another example of a similar nature is locate. This is also found through running my play machines. Someone emailed me a list of files under my the home directory of my administrative account as a demonstration of the machine not working quite as I'd hoped it would work. And basically was that locate had similar code saying if your UID is 0, then bypass all checks. Until it was a case of actually removing two lines of code to have this work correctly. So it removes this check. And what locate... Well, firstly, who knows in concept how locate works? Have a show of hands? Okay, well, a couple of people. So locate, you have one program that's run as a cron job that basically does a find slash operation and makes a database of all files in the file system. And then when you run the locate utility to say, I want to locate a file, it'll first, that program will be set UID or set GID, and it'll look at the database, find the files that match, and then try and stat them. And if it can't stat the file due to the file either having been removed or due to having insufficient privileges to access the directory, then it will just not return the result. And this is the right way to design for security. Well, I said, well, setting these files is a bit of take a bit of time, and if you're running as root, you want to run faster, so let's just remove that check. And that was okay, I guess, if you're not using SE Linux, but if you're using SE Linux, it's not what you want. And this is another of the issues that we found with running play machines. And then there was one that was run by someone else that was owned by a friend of the person who ran it. So the guy was running his play machine, and his friend said, hey, can you log in an administrative account for me? And this is something that should ring some alarm bells. But the guy says, oh, sure, no problems. So he logs in, and he logs in as his account with the staff role, which had the same home directory as the unprivileged account. And that home directory was writable by the unprivileged user. And so what happened was his .bashrc or similar files had been modified by his friend who was the attacker in this instance. And there's an SE Linux command called new role, which is only used in the strict policy. So most people use SE Linux won't actually use this because the targeted policy that's used by most people doesn't have this roles feature in a usable manner. And so they ran the new role command to get the administrative role set at _R. And it didn't work. The reason why it didn't work was new role being replaced by a shell function. And the shell function would basically run cache, I think it was net cache, and send the password out over the net somewhere. And before this guy worked out why the new role command wasn't working the way he expected, his friend had logged in, changed all the passwords, and locked him out of his own machine. It was a good learning lesson. And so if you're running any type of environment of a similar nature, you want to have separate home directories for each user and make sure that each user can only write their own home directory. Because any time a user can write to your home directory, they can totally own you in every way possible. And also, the same issue applies to things like NFS. And if you have an NFS set up with home directories, if one of any hostile person can mount the home directories, they could take over the shell scripts used on login and get the same result to own an entire network by owning one machine or just by plugging a remote or a random NFS client to it. How much time do I have, by the way?
Lots.
Okay, that's good. One thing that I've done when running play machines is to try and, to the greatest extent possible, Protect the people logging the machines from their own mistakes. As a general, for example, as a general rule, if you're logging into a machine that you don't entirely trust, which I think for most people should be any machine that you don't personally own and run, then you should not use X11 forwarding or auth forwarding. So X11 forwarding and auth forwarding are really only suitable for machines where they have the same ownership and maintenance for all the machines. So if you, for example, if you're at work, you use your work machine to log into a server at work, they're run by the same people. If one of them is cracked, the other gets cracked because that's the way things are probably going to work. So you could trust that sort of login. But if it's a case of, for example, your own personal desktop versus your work network, I would never use X11 forwarding because a lot of companies I work for, they don't have much idea of security, and I won't trust the security of my laptop to their security of their network. So when I'm running Play machines, I disable these functions in the SSH server. And of course, if an attacker succeeded in properly owning the machine, which of course could be done through a kernel security vulnerability, then they could of course change SSH configuration in this regard and then start owning users to log in. But I try and, you know, as much as possible protect people. Now, one time I had a guy from Germany claim to have cracked one of my Play machines. And he changed the channel topic on the RC channel to say that he cracked the machine. So I had a look at it. I mean, I was still logged into my own account. It looked okay. I noticed there was a bunch of like 0-minute logins from various people around the world. So I logged in onto the user role and was kicked out instantly. So basically he had a shell script that would look for new logins and just kill the shell. And his idea was that he'd crack the machine by pretty other people logging in. Of course, he still couldn't do anything that I didn't permit him to do. And I could still kill his shell and kill the process that was doing this, which I did. So he was out of there. And I noticed that he'd tried to use X11 forwarding. So I invited him to log in again. And I just changed the configuration of SSH data to allow the forwarding. And just to show him how things work, I ran XLogo. I said, "Can you see the XLogo window on your screen?" And he said, "No." I said, The person who has the XLogo window on their screen, I can display anything I want on their screen, and I can read the keyboard if I want. Do you give me permission to do that to this random person who's not you, who has this X-logo on their screen? Because if it's not you, you shouldn't mind, should you? And he logged in instantly and never came back. Which I guess he was probably trying to trick me and say, looking at this X-logo window and saying, "No, I can't see it." It's a bit of a laugh. Another thing is surprised me from my logs on the Play machine. I make the bash history file append only. So it just keeps getting longer with more entries as users log in. And the number of times people type commands like format C colon just amazes me. Seriously. Firstly, how can someone know how to log into my machine, know how to use SSH login to a Unix box, and then not know that format C colon isn't going to work? And actually, there is no C colon. And that perhaps they should even try, I mean, if they tried DR C colon first, and that didn't work, and they gave up an idea, I mean, that would make a little bit of sense. Not even try DR, not even realize there is no C colon before trying to format it. It's kind of strange. But good for a few quick laughs. And another interesting report I had from a Play machine user was, he claimed to have exploited my Play machine to get the history out of Bash. All he had to do was kill -11 of a bash shell to make bash dump core, then run strings on the core file, and he got the history. Of course, you could just type the command history at the bash prompt to get the same data with much less work, or just cat the .bash history file. And I'm at a loss to explain how a guy could know the program dump core and then run strings on the core file, but not know about the history command and that the file is just there on disk and readable. But it full points of trying, though. In the early days, I had a lot of people writing assembler programs to call getuid. So they thought they weren't really root. And I was somehow tricking them into thinking they were root. And if they called getuid via assembly, then it would say some other number, and they would expose my trick. Which was, again, was a good try. I mean, it's good that they know how to use the assembly and do this. Possibly to attract a few points for their attempt for doing the assembly on my box, because if you're thinking along those lines, I mean, surely you should think that maybe I've compromised GCC to mess things up in that regard. But They could, of course, gone to the NSA website or any other site's information on it and just read about what SELinux is about, which would explain how it works and realize what's going on. And one of the funniest was, a couple of years ago, there was a guy posted to the Debian Devel mailing list, asked for help in cracking machines. So I thought for a laugh, I sent him an email saying, oh, here's a machine you want to log into, and here's the root password. And so he logged in twice and tried to do some stuff, like creating device nodes and creating files and such, SBIN, etc. They sent me an email thanking me for the root account I'd just given him, saying that for some reason his rootkit wouldn't install properly. Could he give me some further advice on how to get it working properly? And the funny thing was, though, after I gave him this, and then I went to bed, and the next morning I got up and I thought, I stuffed up. The message of the day says, this is an SELinux play machine. This is designed to demonstrate security features. I should have changed the message of the day to fool the guy. But no, he logged in twice. The message scrolled past his screen twice, and he didn't read it once. So that was okay, I guess. I think I've covered the... do we have any questions at this stage about SELinux play machines? No? Okay. Should I talk about further developments in SE Linux, further developments in general Linux security? Yep.
Two things. How many are there play machines?
At the moment, one.
But you just keep one.
Yeah.
Sorry, can you just repeat the question so
sure.
That the people recording can
The question is, how many play machines are there? Simple answer is one, because there's one right now. On average, there is one play machine. The maximum we ever had was three. A couple of years ago, I was running a Fedora play machine. Someone's running a Debian one, and there's a hardened Gentoo one as well. But most of the play machines are up very briefly. I own operation of play machines. Over the last 6 years, I've probably got about 2.5-3 years of uptime of play machines. The reason is that it takes a bit of work to keep the machine up to date with all security patches and things, and track what people are doing, and sometimes I just don't have the time. Yeah, back to your question. Good question. Okay. A rundown on distribution support for SE Linux. I'll start with Debian first, because Debian had it first, basically. So in late 2001, I started working on SE Linux. It took me about 3 months to get the code to be built as Debian packages in a reasonable manner, about another 3 months to get a machine actually booting correctly. And so in mid-2002, it was all working pretty well. And since then, the support from Debian has sort of been limping along ever since. So every so often I do some work and get things going reasonably well, and then other things change and break things. Etch has SE Linux now working reasonably well. So for the targeter policy, firstly I'll just briefly explain the two policies. The strict policy used to be known as just the example policy, which is the original NSA policy. And that policy is designed to restrict all programs as much as possible. And this means also restricting user shells. So you have multiple roles for users, so you can isolate different classes of users, and the users themselves are restricted in what they can do. The downside means that programs such as mPlayer were often not permitted to do what they wanted to do, because they wanted to do unusual things. And even without programs like mPlayer, which were problematic, things like, there are a variety of daemons which could be configured in various ways, and there are a lot of ways of doing it which aren't standard and possibly aren't recommended, which people want to use. And the upshot of this was that with strict policy, for any reasonably complex installation, you would have some things we need to make minor changes to policy for. These changes weren't very difficult, usually things like a one-line change to policy, but this was enough to make people turn SE Linux off and complain about it. So a new policy was developed, the targeted policy. And targeted policy, the aim of that was restrict certain targets only. So the initial policy was a small set of daemons. There was Apache, Bind, DHCPD, and a few other things were restricted, so that if they were compromised, there would be little damage done, and everything else on the system was unconfined. And that includes user shells. So with the target policy, every user can do anything user permissions allow them to do. So with the target policy, the potential user base was greatly increased, because for probably most users, they could install SE Linux without even knowing they'd done it, and you'll just do stuff without noticing and caring, apart from not being compromised as often. So now the Debian Etch support for targeted policy is quite good, and just everything just sort of basically works. Strict policy doesn't work, and I'm working that right now. My aim is that Debian Lenny, the next version of Debian, will have full support for the strict policy. Fedora, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and CentOS, because they're all based on the same tree, they all have support for the target and strict policies, and also the MLS policy. MLS stands for multi-level security, and it's the aim of this policy is to meet the labeled security protection profile of common criteria certification. And this was used by both IBM and Hewlett-Packard independently to get certifications under LSPP, which allows them to make lots of big sales to secretive US government organizations. Which is the point of it. There's also some interest in MLS policy from students who have the idea that if they want to get a job at the NSA or DSD or whatever, then knowing about MLS, which is also known as the Bell LaPadula model, will help them get a job. I don't know, and I'll probably never know whether that will actually help them get a job or not, but it sounds like a reasonable theory, and it's good to get them involved with their C-Linux work. Now, the MLS policy, I haven't even started trying to get on in Debian yet, so after we get strict policy going, then I'll look at MLS, but that'll be a lot of work. And so Lenny probably won't have MLS support. Hardin Gentoo had S-Linux support not long after Debian. They've done a lot of good work there. One issue with Gentoo is that their focus is on Linux for server. The reason is a couple of the main Hardin Gentoo people have no interest in Linux on desktop. I mean, there's one guy who's totally committed to Windows on the desktop. So his idea is use Windows desktop to log into a Linux server. And he has total lack of interest in Linux on desktop, and therefore doesn't sort of work in his Gentoo Hardin work towards this goal. So as all of this, I mean, Gentoo is more focused on the server, but it should still work on a desktop as well with SE Linux. And they're also mostly focused on the strict policy, but I think they've also got target as well. And another thing about the Hardin Gentoo people is that they're not very interested in MLS policy. I'm not interested in using it either, but I think it's worth supporting, whereas they think it's not worth supporting or using, really. Now, there have been some various attempts to get other distributions. Well, there's another one. I think there's Guardian Digital or something has a Linux distribution that's got AC Linux in it. And they've asked me to review it, but I haven't had time. So that's apparently got some reasonable support for AC Linux, but I haven't had a chance to check it out. And there have been a few other attempts to get other distributions supporting. I mean, there have been various attempts to get Slackware running with AC Linux. And I think one of my friends, Paul Doryhouse, did some work on getting SUSE to work with AC Linux. He did that a few years ago, and now I think he's about to go back to working on that. So maybe he'll have some SUSE support in a few months. We'll see. But generally, Red Hat-based distributions work best for AC Linux at the moment. My aim is to have Debian catch up rapidly in the Lenny timeframe, and Hardin Gentoo is there for server stuff. Now, was that your any other questions? Okay, Annabelle?
Ah, what's about the legal warning that you have?
I'm sorry?
What legal warning do you have?
On my Play machine?
Yeah.
I can't remember it. Yeah, best you just log in to read it. The question is, what legal warning do I have on the machine? I can't remember what I wrote, because I wrote it a while ago. It's the best to log in to actually see what it is. One of the things that I put in was that I demand that people not give other people the password, that they refer other people to my website or a T-shirt to get it. A T-shirt because I want to promote T-shirts, and a website because that's got all the background information. One problem I had in the early days was a lot of people just given the IP address and the password over IRC and have no idea what it's about, and they just go, hey, here's a Linux box I can play with. What can I do? Well, I can't install a rootkit, so I'll just try and trash it and do a fork bomb. And it just gets really annoying. And so I want people to actually know what they're doing. So if they get given the password via the website, they'll read the information background to it of what the project's about and not get the wrong idea. And in Pennsylvania, it is a crime to give someone a password to a system without the permission of the machine's owner. So I have debates with people about this, and they say, oh, you can't stop me giving the password out. Well, it's illegal in at least one place, and so the debate about whether it's ethical or not, if it's illegal in one part of the US, which incidentally is where a lot of the people who log in come from, surely that's a strong indication that you should think about whether it's ethical or not to do that. And of course, I can't enforce any of these things because people log in from all around the world randomly, so I just write the rules, and then when they fork bomb the machine to death, I just reboot it again. One thing I'm doing at the moment is I'm running my Play machine under Xen, which means when I want to reboot it after a fork bomb, I have to SSH to the DOM 0 to do it, rather than actually press reset. And also means that I have some more potential to actually view what's going on when you get to a denial of service attack. Well, speaking of which, denial of service attacks, some years ago I woke up one morning to find the play machine's hard drive making grinding sounds, and it was logging messages from IP tables to prevent my machine being used to attack other machines, which a lot of people try. I have a local IP table installation on the machine to stop what it sends out, and then on the router connects to, I have a separate IP table installation. So even if someone was to own my play machine, they still couldn't send out anything other than unless it's coming from TCP source port 22. So anyway, I noticed that my logs being filled by IP table stuff. So I just killed the port scanning process running. I just wrote a message to the guy's screen saying, hey, you know, this isn't working. The packets aren't going out anywhere. And so he just ignored me and just started port scanning again. So we ended up having to block his IP address from logging in because he just didn't take the warnings. And surprisingly, he'd been running this thing for hours. And he was obviously there watching it because when I killed his process, he started up again pretty quickly. He watched it for hours and hadn't worked out that there might be some reason why several hours of port scanning didn't receive a single positive response. I mean, surely, you know, after the first hour or so, you think, you know, I should have got one positive response from now. I mean, there must be some reason why every single host I try and scan has no responses. And also, if you're being methodical about these things, if you're doing support scanning, you'd have a machine you know is open, and you scan that one machine first, and you get a positive from that, and you say, okay, I know my port scanning process is working, and now I can go through and scan other things usefully. Whereas if you don't know that you can actually get a positive response, there's no point even really doing it. And the fact that he just run dmessage and just see all the IP tables messages was just amazing. He never thought to do that. I even sent a message saying, why don't you run dmessage and see that your packets are being denied? And he didn't. Anyway, other questions? Okay. Yep.
Do any distributions enable SE Linux by default? What sort of effect does that have for you?
Good question. Okay. Do distributions have SE Linux enabled by default? Fedora, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and CentOS, because they all come from the same source tree and all have the same ideas, they all have SE Linux enabled by default, but it is the targeted policy. So the targeted policy means, just say you're going to install a Fedora desktop. So you install your desktop machine and you log in. Your login session has no restrictions, whether it's logged in via GDM, via a terminal login, via SSH. So for that, you have no restrictions, so you're not noticing any issues. Restrictions are on a certain select number of daemons. And some of these daemons, there isn't much in the configuration options. Like, for example, DHCPD. There's little in the way of radical differences to configure DHCPD. You just have a list of which IP addresses serve out, etc. It reads from plain text file and just does it. So with this, there is not much possibility of getting things wrong. So if you're running DHCPD on a server, SE Linux really isn't going to stop you doing anything. Unless there is something broken, like say a file mislabeled. That's a separate issue. Apache is the problem area. Apache, I believe, is the most configurable daemon there is for Linux. I'm not aware of any daemon which has the range of configuration options of Apache, and the range of whether options are sensible or not, depending on what your definition of sensible might be. So there are things that people want to try and do. For example, let's have Apache run a script as root and then have a user web page to change their password. There are reasons for wanting to do this. But for most people, you don't want to do this sort of thing at all. And so having any script that's run from Apache change write to the shadow password file is usually something you don't want to have. So of course, the default policy doesn't allow this. And there are billions to allow scripts to run without restriction. So you'd have a CGIBN script run unconfined, which means SE Linux doesn't restrict it at all. And then the script will be able to do things like change passwords. But by default configuration is you can't do that. And this means, of course, that a lot of Apache configurations have issues with this. And usually fairly simple things. Even trivial stuff like, say, for example, Apache is configured to have the web content being served from /var/www. A common practice among system administrators is you buy a machine to do a certain task. And you say, this machine I've purchased is for task being web server. I have a separate file system that has my web data because that's what the machine's about. The FHS might say it should be on a var lib or var run or whatever. No, this machine is for one purpose, so I'll mount my file system under the root directory. I'll have slash www, because that's the purpose of the machine. I think this is a sensible thing for an administrator to do. And so, of course, you have this Apache serving data out of a non-standard location, and that means that the SELinux label, default labeling, doesn't label it such that Apache can read it. And then Apache is blocked from doing its job. It's a very simple thing to solve. One option is that you can run chcon, which is the SELinux equivalent to chmod or chown, to change the security context of the files. So you change the context of the files, and it just works. And if you ask a question on IRC, or you read a FAQ or something, you'll find out how to solve these things. Often people don't want to do that. There is another option is to run Apache with no restrictions. There's a Boolean in the target policy for every daemon to say, run this daemon with no restrictions. You set the Boolean to true, and then you restart the daemon, and it runs no restrictions, and then from then on, that daemon will not be stopped from doing things based on Linux. Of course, if that daemon is attacked by someone over the net, then it's bad for you. But this is the choice you make. And another thing to do with SE Linux is, if you have a file system for files for a particular daemon, there is a mount option for the file system. And you can say, I want every file in this file system to have a certain security context. And there are several benefits to this. One is that if you have a file with a file system with a large number of files, say you've got 10 million files in a file system. Now, one thing you might like to do occasionally is to verify the integrity of your machine. And you say, I want to make sure this file system has files of the context that I believe they should have. Checking 10 million files will take some time, and you don't really want to do that. If you mount the file system with a mount option saying that every file will have certain context, then there is no doubt, because the mount option takes precedence. Another issue is the issues of disk space and possibly computation time. The ext2 and ext3 file systems, when they store exadders, they can use one block for multiple exadders for a file. So, for example, if you have 1,000 files with the same combination, exadder name and value, they will all point to the same block. So then take one block for 1,000 files, which is an efficient use of space. There'll be some downsides to this in terms of time taken for writing the exadders, but on balance, I think it's a very good feature. Other file systems don't have this for various other reasons. XFS, for example, doesn't have this feature as far as I'm aware, or any plans to have it. And so every file has an exadder, will have a separate bit of disk space allocated to it, which uses that much. The recent version of XFS that's come out will have the exadders for SE Linux stored in a more efficient way than the old version. The older version took a 4K block for each exadder, and if made with default options, which took a bit of disk space. So, for example, in a hypothetical situation, you've got a mail server, 10 million files on an XFS file system. You create it with the default MKFS options. That'll take a 4K block for each file. That's not what you want. You could have fixed this by using a different version of the file system. You could have fixed this by using a different mount option. But if you've already got the file system there with files in place, you just use a mount option to label the entire file system with SE Linux, and the problem's solved easily. Now, back to the original question of whether users notice about this. Most system administrators don't run Apache. And I use the term system administrator broadly. In a broader sense, it encompasses every single Linux user who installs Linux on their home desktop. If you're running your home desktop yourself, you're a system administrator. In most cases, a fairly junior one, but still a system administrator. So you install Linux on your desktop, you don't run Apache there. The chances are, if you install Fedora, you'll be running SE Linux and you won't even really know about it, because it won't affect you anyway. Okay, I think I've addressed that question adequately. Are there any further questions? Okay, next thing I'd like to talk about is the MCS versus MCS MLS policies. MLS, as I mentioned before, is an implementation of the Bell LaPadula model. There are a few minor variations among Bell LaPadula. I believe the original design of Bell LaPadula had that every process could write to a file that was of equal or higher security classification. So if you had a process running at secret level, it could write to a top secret file, because that's not an information leak. What Bell LaPadula is about is information leaks and preventing them. So you can't read a file that's more privileged than your process, and you can't write to a file that's less privileged. So information can go up, but not down. A fairly common change to this, which is implemented in SE Linux, is to not allow writing above your level either. Because writing to a file that you can't read from is generally inconvenient, and in many situations won't actually work. One thing to consider about the Bell Lepagetel model is that it can't be applied only to files. It has to be applied to directories, pipes, all forms of process communication, including IP networking. And for example, TCP doesn't work very well without AX. So with TCP communications, you have to have the same level for both client and server. And that means that it makes some sense to have the entire model of the OS based on that, because there is no real pressing need for writing multi-level. Now, MCS was developed by James Morris of Red Hat, and the aim of MCS is to use some of the MLS features in a way that will give benefits to people other than military organizations. MLS is a very strict policy for protecting secrecy of data, and it's good, it is effective at what it does, but it is very hard to use. And even among people whose job it is to do such things, and people who work for military agencies, they'll tell you that it is very hard to use MLS. And it's not really a viable thing to use for regular user systems. So MCS is designed to use some of the features. One of the reasons for this is that, in fact, one of the reasons for the entire Ethelinux project is that a feature that's used by few people is supported by few programs. And it makes it very hard for everyone. So the problem with the various so-called trusted versions of commercial operating systems that has been around for decades is that these operating systems are used by a very small number of agencies. They're sold for very high prices, so most people can't afford a copy if they wanted them. And the people who are experienced in using this software are employees and past employees of these agencies. So if you're, say, a military agency and you wanted to use a trusted version of commercial Unix, the first thing you want to do is say, okay, I need to hire some administrators who know how this works. Who can I hire? Well, people have worked for other agencies already. This is a very small pool of people. It means the pay rates go up a lot. So if you happen to get a job with one of these agencies and get trained with one of these trusted Unixes, your next job will be very highly paid because you've got skills there that most people don't have and most people can't get, ever. With proprietary software, you can't say, I want to learn this software. With SE Linux, everyone can get a copy. You can download a copy of Fedora or CentOS or a demo version of Red Enterprise Linux tonight, install the MLS policy, and start learning how to run machines in the way that military agencies run them. And therefore, if you want to get a job at these military agencies, you know, you've got some background information. And this means that the idea is that for these agencies, their staff costs will go down because they'll be able to more easily hire people. And they could say, you know, it would be even possible to say for a job interview, well, your CV is reasonably good, you seem to know your stuff. If you could investigate this technology before your second interview, then it would really help you. And so the person, you could instruct someone, you know, please look at Fedora with MLS before your second job interview. And they could do that. You can't say, you know, please look at this trusted proprietary operating system before your second job interview. You can't do that. Another thing is that the software costs. One example is backup software. Every machine that's important needs to be backed up some way. And you want to have backup software that can support the labeling of files, so if you restore, you don't grant inappropriate access. But for the majority of backup companies that produce backup software, they only write software for the common uses. And if the so-called trusted version of a proprietary operating system is not in common use, they'll have little incentive to write the software. And if they do, there'll be a custom version, which might have bugs other than the standard version. It might lack features. It might be released three versions behind. And it might cost huge amounts of money. Whereas the aim with the SELinux project is that this software will become common. Everyone will have the features. And you'll just save money for people who need these features all along the line. So along these, so for these reasons, it was a very good incentive to have the some of the basic MLS features available for every Fedora user. So the basic features in question are the labeling of files. So you want to have the same data structures used for labeling the files and processes. So any process that interacts with these data structures for use in MCS could then work with MLS without, hopefully without any changes at all, and to save a lot of money for people who actually want to use software in that way. So the MCS policy was devised. And now the MLS policy, as the name multi-level security suggests, it has levels. Did anyone see the t-shirt I was wearing 2 days ago? Okay, so I had a t-shirt with sort of penguins in two layers and one level above the other and with different compartments for the penguins to try and illustrate the content of MLS. I'll wear a similar t-shirt later in the week, so you can, if you see me perhaps tomorrow, you'll see me with the other t-shirt. So with MLS, you have levels. So for example, data at a top secret level cannot go to the secret level in any way. And you also have categories, or also known as compartments. Categories are the name used in Linux, but they're also known as compartments in other software. And so these categories will be used often on a project basis. So in an organization where they have a goal of secrecy, you might say, okay, for every new project we create, we'll create a new category. And then if you have a program running, storing data related to that project, you start with that category, and therefore programs running for other projects can't read the data. And to be able to read data, you must have a level that is equal or higher than the level of data you're reading, and a set of categories that are a superset of categories of the data in question. And to write to a file or other writable resource, there's a pipe or a network socket, the target of your write operation must have an equal level to your process, an equal set of categories. That's in the MLS model. In MCS, the idea is that you just have a set of categories that's greater than or equal to the object you're accessing, and there's only one level, so levels aren't relevant. James Morris's idea for MCS was to have MCS be an advisory security model. So most of these things aren't actually enforced, and a process can arbitrarily spawn a trial process with a different set of categories. So his idea is that categories are used to help people who want to do the right thing. So if you know what your job is in an accounting, you know, if I read the HR files and I'm not in the HR department, then it will be a big problem for me and I might get sacked. So I don't want to do that, but I want to know which files I should be reading. So I look at a file, okay, that's a HR file, I won't touch it. I could, you know, run a process under different contexts and access, but I know better than to do that. I have a disagreement with James about this, and I believe that this isn't what people would desire to use. So my belief is that we ought to have a mandatory version of MCS. So for Debian, I've got a policy I call the mandatory MCS policy, which does much the same thing, but enforces everything. And so you can't run a new process with a greater set of categories than the parent process. And so your login session can have a set of categories assigned to it, and you can never gain more categories. Also, I have ranges used in MCS. A range means you have both a high level and a low level of privilege. And so the categories are numbered from 0 to 1023. So in my mandatory MCS policy, I have a process with a low range of C0, category 0, and a high range of C0 to C100. And that means I can read and write all files with those categories from 0 to 100. But for me to be able to, I can read all files with categories from C0 to C100, but for me to be able to write to a file, it must have C0. So every data I write to will have C0 attached to it. And that means that if I have a process and I say, I don't want this process to leak data, this process has important data related to project A, I'll put its low level be that, I'll make its low level be the category for project A, and therefore SLinux will not permit it to leak this data. Now, MCS at the moment does not restrict direct access. So this means, for example, you could export the data by a number of create a number of files with data in it. So if you want to, so if you could, you could, for example, convert a text file to a series of files created in a directory, where each file be 1,000 characters long and have 1,000 characters of data. One of the things about SLinux is it has never had a goal of protecting against covert channels. It's been totally outside the scope of the project. Covert channel attack is a very hard thing to solve and requires serious controls over resource usage that are totally at odds with the way the Linux kernel is designed. And I don't think it would be practical to try and get Linux to work in that manner. And so it's been declared outside the scope of the project. With MCS not restricting direct access, that just makes it's a slightly bigger example of covert channel attack. So you can't write to a file with full data, but you could export it in other ways. To properly protect against these things, one thing you need to have is polling center directories. Who here knows about polling center directories? Okay. There's some people in SGI who didn't put their hands up. You should have put your hands up, guys. I saw your one, Greg, yeah. Okay, point center directories means that you can have a directory name which maps to multiple different directories for different processes or users. For example, /tmp is the most obvious example. There have been numerous security flaws in applications and daemons reported over the years related to temp file recognitions. Things such as program A writes to a file, program B reads from it, can it be interfered with in the meantime? Program A writes to a file but doesn't check whether it exists or not, and it could be previously existing and owned by a different user. A program opens a file for write access without checking that, whether it exists and doesn't know it's a symbolic link to the shadow password file or something. There have been heaps of these. And so obviously, if you can isolate the different processes who have different privilege levels to their versions of the temp directory, you can solve a lot of potential problems. The current ones have been solved, but I mean, it's a case of whack-a-mole. Every so often we find another program which has another temp file recognition, and we fix it, and then we find another one. And there's also a large number of programs run by regular users that have these recognitions. And a lot of people think, well, if a program is running as non-root, as a regular user, then what's the problem? Well, it can still be used for attack. I mean, one example, a good example is strace. Strace has a murder operation, which you say, I want my output file to be /tmp/strace. And I want child processes to have their output named files such as /tmp/strace.pidnumber. It makes sense. And where do you want to put your strace output files? The temp directory is a good place for it because you don't want to have these things lying around in the home directory and wasting space. Now you've got a quota there. Okay, so if these files have been created, and the name and the PID files in Linux are sequential, so any attacker can predict what the next PID might be for your process you're tracing, create a file under that name, and strace doesn't, or last time I checked, didn't do proper checks when it opened the file. So this is an obvious attack vector against the user waiting to happen. So the solution to this is to have each user have a different version of the temp directory. So the temp directory is mapped to /tmp/instantiation/username, and the directory name instantiation has mode 0, so only root processes could go under it. Then you're reasonably safe against some of these attacks. Of course, there are still other potential possibilities, like, for example, the user runs a setuid or setgid program which has the same temp directory as them, and if that program is then trying to attack them, in most cases, the program would succeed anyway, because most setuid and setgid programs are designed to run with the privileges of the calling user and the privileges of the setgid or setuid operation, and don't actually spawn a new process under a different user ID. The only example, or counterexamples, are things like SU, of course. But I mean, having different versions of the temp directory for users and for daemons as well has the potential to solve a lot of these problems. One thing I would like to see done, which apparently hasn't been done, hasn't been of interest to many people yet, is to have daemons have different versions of directories such as the temp directory. It seems to me that there's yep.
Yep. Thought that often you leak information off the encrypted file system into.
Yeah.
And just try to maybe.
Okay, great point. So the question is, okay, just say I've got an encrypted home directory, and then I want to edit a file, and this file is important, so important that even the name of the file is a secret. So I load up my editor, and my editor creates a temporary file, /tmp/filename.tmp, and then every user can ls the temp directory and see what this file name is. And the question is, can point center directories solve this? The answer is yes, if you configure it right. The configuration of the PAM namespace module used for point center directories allows you to set arbitrary paths for where the original version of the directory is. So you can point center directory to from /temp to be /home/user/temp. And of course, there is the temp to your environment variable. And if every program used the temp to your environment variable, and if every user used it, because users use file names like /tmp/whatever, it's a matter of habit. But if programs and users use the temp to your environment variable, things would be a lot easier, but they don't, and they won't. So if we had /temp mapped to /home/user/temp, which is not that hard to do, it's a configuration option, then you would have all data being stored in one place. But this is also a design choice. I mean, One thing that's also reasonably common amongst administrators is you give users a quota. You say, okay, every user has 4 meg quota. And we have a 2 gig file system in slash temp. So you want to create some big files temporarily, use slash temp, no problems. But then you've got to store the compressed version, whatever, in your home directory. And this model of operation is of course, broken if you have the point-sensitive temp directory going to the user's home directory. So this is, again, a choice for the administrator. It depends on what your situation is.